AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This podcast was recorded live during the Racing in America event at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. You'll find two shows in your podcast feed this week, and this one is all about racing. You'll have to excuse the music and activity in the background, but that's what allowed us to bring you a great lineup of guests. And in fact, I'll be jumping in from time to time to identify who those guests are. So sit back and enjoy this special event from the Henry Ford. This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, Episode 59, Part 1, for Thursday, June 10th, 2010, Racing in America. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. This week's program was recorded at the Henry Ford Museum, where they were holding a special event to kick off a fundraising program to develop a new exhibit there that they're calling Racing in America. Joining me as always for this was the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo, and the first guest that we had was none other than Jack Roush, who had just received an innovation award from the Henry Ford Museum, and I started out by asking him what he got it for.
Well, I guess in a general automotive racing subjects, you know, the question of where the roof flap came from, I get some credit for having built a roof flap that works for the cars, but the actual idea came from the General Motors laboratory that I was exposed to and picked up the idea and converted it into a functioning system that could upset the airfoil that went over the top of the car when it went sideways.
So this is an award from the museum itself?
It's an award from the museum itself. You know, the museum has always had a focus on innovation, but they're starting to even create more of an attention to innovation, particularly innovation as it relates to motorsports. They're bringing their Racing in America exhibition to the museum soon, and I know that there have been a number of people around town, a number of race teams that are going to contribute for it, but they're interested in not only having innovation as it relates to all the different disciplines in our economy and in our society, but also in racing as well.
You've gotten all kinds of awards. You ever get one from a museum before?
Yes, I have several.
No kidding.
This is one of the first ones that I got when they at the time they gave me the museum today. They didn't ask me again, when is your last day? When do you retire? Retirement's not soon. I often tell them, I says, you might have just saved this and give it to me another time, because if it's a pre-retirement thing, I don't want it right yet.
So, Jack, your team's always done pretty well at Michigan. What do you think the prospects are this weekend?
You know, I am more excited about going to race at MIS this year than any year I can remember. You know, we've got three of our cars in chase, but we have been off just a little bit on things. We raced our nationwide cars last week in Nashville and had four cars driven by six drivers throughout the weekend that did not have a problem that had plagued us all year in both series. So I think that we've identified an area of concern. It's an area that I've been suspicious about. And if we've gotten it, and if it transfers from the nationwide to the Cup Series, we could become a factor in winning a race and not just being consistent as we've been.
I imagine you can't give it away completely, but what area were you suspicious where you thought you had some room to make up?
It was connected between the tires and the chassis. It's where the rubber meets the road. That's of course.
So these days, when you say you're a little off in NASCAR, that's like a couple of tenths, right?
Well, the whole thing, it started off to be like a series of maybe a dozen. Remember the time with Christmas light bulbs? Christmas tree bulbs were in a series, and if you had one bulb that would be bad in 12, you'd have trouble. And you get too bad in 12 and you can never fix it. Well, now there's about 50 of the darn light bulbs, and I'm sure that there's two or three of them that are not right, and you got to pick the right two or three or you just never get it fixed.
You know, Peter and I talk a lot about the need to use motor racing as a way to develop technology in the motor industry. So it's cool to see you getting this kind of award. Wouldn't you like to see the same thing, more emphasis put back in racing as to help the car guys develop their cars?
Well, that's a real that's a real tough point. You know, one of the things that NASCAR in particular tries to do is limit innovation that would result in obsolescence and in increased cost to everybody. So they've not been a real strong innovator for taking every new idea that come along and putting it in a race car and in obsolete and create all those costs. But NASCAR is on its way to, we're going to have fuel injection soon, we're going to have ethanol fuel blend soon, and those things are going to be very innovative on NASCAR's part, and I think the whole automotive community is anxious to see those things occur.
So, Jack, you started out building drag race engines, didn't you, way back when?
I started actually with a group of 10 engineers, production control managers, purchasing agents, had one nuclear physicist, all of whom worked for Ford, as I did. 10 of us went drag racing in 1965. And then eventually I wound up having my own team, not the club's team, but my own team with a fellow by the name of Wayne Gapp, who had also been a Ford engineer. And we went pro stock racing and won NHRA championships, and then the rest is history.
And you also taught school at night, didn't you?
I taught school at night for 2 years, and I taught to school in the daytime for 2 years as well. So I had
and taught physics.
And I taught some physics and some trigonometry, math.
I think
and
that's
things.
A lot. I'm glad you brought that up because I think a lot of people don't know that you were a college professor teaching
well,
physics.
I was assistant professor at a junior college in the area here. But we had actually the focus of that community college was to prepare youngsters on a two-year program to become technicians for emissions work, technicians for fuel calibration work, technicians for engine design for the car companies.
Yeah, that's really great.
So I've really been around this Ford thing, this automotive thing in Detroit since 1964. It makes me feel very old, but still got a lot of energy for what's in front, as do you and a lot of other people been around it for a long time as well.
Been around a long time, you bet. I understand, since we're in a museum, that you've got a museum of your own as well.
Yeah, well, as soon as you're finished with me and release me, and I've got to rush off to my daughter Susan's museum in Livonia. She's got a couple of hundred race cars, prototype cars, a number of old restored flathead Fords. I've got a Viper in there, and I've got Pontiac in there, a couple of Pontiac race cars and things.
Open but to the public?
To the public. We're having a cruise in tonight at, I can't tell you what the address is. It's on Market Street off Plymouth Road in Livonia. Mm-hmm. And we're signing autographs. A number of the drivers, are already there. Thursday night before every Michigan race at Susan's Museum in Livonia, we have an open house and have a car show. And there'll be a couple thousand people there.
Fantastic.
Maybe we
fantastic.
Should be there next year.
Next year, yeah.
Well,
we'll do it in 6 weeks. For the next race this summer.
Yeah.
I'll give you a call.
Terrific, Jack. Fantastic. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Take care, guys. Appreciate it.
As Jack Roush ran out to go to the opening of his own museum, we were able to get one of his top drivers, Greg Biffle, who's absolutely one of the top drivers in NASCAR.
Greg, come on in.
How are you guys?
Greg, John McElroy.
Hey, John, how are you?
Greg,
yeah.
Peter DiLorenzo. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Just throw that on here.
Sure.
And for anybody watching now, in case you don't recognize him, we've got Greg Biffle here. Terrific for you to take some time out and come talk with us.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a neat place. So,
you ever been here before?
Yes, I have, but, you know, with the memory I have, it's been about 10 years since I've been here. So it's neat to come back, and you know, I was just talking with some of the guys. I'm like, I'm going to come back when I have more time in the fall. You know, we come to the Roush Museum and sign autographs. I'm going to come up early that day and spend half a day here and be able to look at all this stuff because I got a chance to walk around about 20 minutes and pretty neat stuff.
There's a lot of cool stuff here.
Absolutely,
not just automotive, but of course what attracts us here.
Right, I'm an airplane nut, you know, and the trains. I started to get almost to the train section, and they're like, come on, we need you over here. So
I got to see those giant locomotives.
I know.
You've never seen anything so big inside a building before.
I know. I didn't get a chance. Well, I was actually talking to the security guy about, he was telling me about how they brought them in and cut the building out and actually drove in under its own power, you know, in 1956, I think he said. Hmm. So pretty neat stuff.
That is cool.
So we just talked to Jack, and he said he felt you guys were a little off and that he expects some notable improvements this weekend at Michigan. What do you think?
You know, we're working really hard on our race cars, and you know, the new introduction of the FR9 engine is going to help us. One benefit, not morally, just the power or the little bit better power curve that the engine makes is we're able to run more tape on the front of the race car, better cooling package. You know, a two-mile racetrack like MIS, that's going to make a difference. You know, it should be as much as a tenth a lap.
Plus, you guys have always done well there.
We've always run well there, and tape means, you know, speed and downforce on the front of the car. It's kind of hard to translate that for people that don't know what a piece of duct tape would do, but, you know, it changes the airfoil and gets the air over top of the car instead of trapping it in the car and slowing it down. So with the better cooling package and a little bit better power, you know, we're just now we need to work on fuel mileage. We just got this engine, so, you know, it's going to take us a little time to get better fuel mileage. So and Michigan's always a fuel mileage race, so we're a little nervous.
It's amazing to me how close the competition is in NASCAR. I mean, if you look at it measured in time, the field is extraordinarily close, especially, say, like the top 25. It's got to make it really hard to get out there and get in front of people.
It is. And you know, what happens is when all the cars are so close together, all the cars are the same speed, it makes it so difficult to pass. You know, because you have to be faster than the guy to pass him. And unfortunately, you have to be an absorbent amount or more faster to actually try and get beside him or make the pass. So that's the hardest. When all the cars are so close together, it makes it very difficult to make those passes.
How have you found the newer spoiler as opposed to the one
you were? You know, we were expecting more of a change. We were expecting more of a balance shift. And NASCAR spent a long time on, you know, the shark fin they put on the trunk and then lengthened the quarter panels and did some things. So they really balanced the aero platform back the way it was. I was hoping that the car would be a little looser and, you know, make the cars turn a little bit better, but they add a lot of features back to it. So we didn't get the change we're quite wanting, but I like it a little bit better.
Now, did you run last night at Eldora?
I did not. I had some other commitments, unfortunately, and didn't get a chance. So it looked like a lot of fun, but I'm not much of a dirt guy either. I came from pavement racing, and I'm not as experienced at the dirt, you know, as I need to be, but it looks like fun.
I see Tony Kanaan from IndyCar ran down there, and he was like...
Yeah, it takes a lot. You know, it's a lot different. I've done it. You know, if you don't do it much, it takes... You know, it's not natural to get in there and do the things that you have to do.
Throw it sideways when you're usually fighting not to do that.
Yeah. So
well, there's loose, and then there's way loose.
Right. And then there's the cushion, you know, which we're kind of used to that in pavement terms. You know, we know it's higher than anybody's run. So there's what we call marble. So it gets rubber and dust built up. You get in that, you're in trouble. So same thing, run on the edge. Any kind of racing is run on the edge, right, without going over.
Right.
So when you talk about it being hard to pass because all the cars are so equal, one thing that it looks like now, because television coverage is so much better than it used to be, is it looks like you guys are really sliding in the turns, even on the super speedways. Is that essentially right?
It is. You know, right now, we're going so fast, I guess, and the cars basically slide across the racetrack. I mean, we're out of control. We're in a controlled wreck at all times. I mean, you're going as fast as the car can go all the time. And, you know, it's the guy that can get, you know, his car to go the fastest. And unfortunately, that means, you know, sometimes a little out of control.
Yeah.
The reason I asked that is first time I ever saw NASCAR on TV, this goes back decades ago, you know, with television coverage wasn't that good. It just looked like the cars were on rails and going around and around. Then I went to a NASCAR race live for the first time and had binoculars in the stands and could see how much they were fighting the wheel. And that's when I went, oh, my God. And now because the TV coverage with cameras everywhere has gotten so good, that's when I started to notice how much you're sliding in the turns.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, that it's difficult to slide the car at 100. And, you know, we enter the corner about 210, you know, 208, and the car starts to spin out getting down in the corner. And, you know, we let that car slide the back a little bit as it gets down to the center of the corner, and then we're pushing the gas down as soon as we can. And then it's a matter of it getting loose, and we're having to turn to the right and kind of, you know, get as much throttle as you can down and drive off the corner, let alone you got guys all around you.
Right, and doing it for hours.
Yeah, doing it for 4 hours. So it's not as easy as it looks. It's a difficult thing to manage.
It doesn't look easy to me.
No.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
It's going to be another hot day Sunday.
Yeah, you know, and hot and slick, and, you know, that just, you know, makes it even harder. Yeah. But it's fun. I enjoy it.
Cool. Well, Greg, thanks so much for stopping by.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Good luck on Sunday.
Yep, thank you.
Are you
going to Jack's
Museum thing tonight?
I'm not. I'm here for this, and then we take turns. Part of us go the springtime, part of us go in the fall. So in the fall is my duties.
Cool.
Thank you, guys.
See you then, I hope.
Thanks, Greg.
Yep.
Yeah. Our next guest was Robert Height, who works for John Forrest Racing, one of the preeminent drag racing teams in the country, and I started out by asking him if he had ever been to the Henry Ford Museum before.
Yeah, first time. Unbelievable. No, but I've only been here a few minutes. I got to really get back here to see this thing.
There's amazing stuff here. I mean, that goes back literally hundreds of years.
Yes.
They've mined the world for cool artifacts.
Exactly.
But especially American stuff, but yeah. Not just.
Stuff that we're interested in.
Yeah.
So how's your season progressing?
It's great right now. It's, I've been to, I won 3 in a row,
right.
And then I was in the final last weekend. That's 4 finals in a row, and I just took over the points lead. So, yeah, the Fords have won 7 of 9.
Wow.
So we're doing well. 7 of 10.
Why is Ford on such a roll right now? You guys just got everything clicking, or what?
Yeah, it's a team. John Force Racing is really, we've pulled together over the winter, and it's just everything's right. You got to stay working because, you know, that can change in a hurry.
Well, it's so ultra-competitive. Every time you unload, it's a whole new deal.
Oh, it is. It is. Every racetrack you go to, different set of conditions. But what I like is we've been running good in the hot tracks, and then we've been running good when it's cool, too. So we got the best of both worlds right now.
So what's up next for you? Where are you going next?
We leave tonight and head to Englishtown, New Jersey.
Right. That's a big deal.
There's a lot of history in Englishtown.
Yeah.
You know, I've never won that race, and that's one that, you know, you want to win before you retire. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Gainesville, Englishtown, the tracks on the East Coast, you want to do good there.
So what did you feel about the shortened distance on the drag strip when they did that?
Well, I think it was definitely necessary because, you know, we don't have enough shutdown area for the speeds we're going. And we really don't want to be hit with performance restrictions. You know, there's a lot of things they're looking at, thinking about, maybe taking us back to the quarter mile, but it's still going to slow us down. And, you know, as a drag racer, it's the whole name of the game is quick and as fast as you can go. And if you have to shorten it 300 feet and still be able to run as quick and fast as you go, that's what I think we ought to do.
What do you make of that 4 abreast starts, the one race that they held?
There's mixed feelings on all that. You know, I think it really boils down to the team or the fans. If they want it, that's what we're out there for. That's why Ford pays us and all the other sponsors. We need to do it. But as I'm a big fan of drag racing and the noise that it generates, you know, from you have 4 cars, 8,000 horsepower. That's over 30,000 horsepower hitting the gas, leaving the starting line at once. It's an unbelievable sensation. But I think sometimes some of the fans got a little confused because when you're watching 2 cars go 320 miles an hour, there's a lot to take in there. And then you put 4 of them out there. I mean, it's kind of hard to figure out who was where and
yeah,
what
I
was going on.
I just think drag racing is 2 cars.
2 at a time, yeah.
It looked dramatic on television, though, I'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
Really,
you know,
dramatic.
ESPN did a good job, but I really believe, first off, we need to give Bruton Smith another chance because he spent a lot of money. He's really invested a lot in drag racing. And, you know, maybe there's some things that we can do as racers and the teams and even the media and ESPN to make it a little better. So we're going to give her one more shot next year.
So, Robert, what are the G-loads you pull off the line in your cars?
You hit the throttle, you go about 5 Gs. And then it kind of tapers off. Then in the middle of the racetrack, it starts feeding a lot of clutch, and it gets right back up there to 5 Gs again. Then it kind of levels off, and then at the other end, you hit the chutes, and then it goes to -4. And, I mean, that slams you around in the car. But there's actually been guys detach retinas in their eyes from the parachutes.
But what you've just described takes how many seconds?
Yeah, it happened quicker than I just described that.
Well, it's nice to see someone who enjoys what they do so much.
Oh, man, I'm so lucky, you know, and to be on the team that I'm on. You know, I've worked for John Force for over 15 years and worked on his car, and he gave me the opportunity to do this. It's like the luckiest guy in the world. One of the best cars there is out there, you know. Winning championships, winning races. You know, I sometimes pinch myself.
Plus, it's easy to have conversations because you can just let John talk.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's never at a loss for words.
Well, Robert, we wish you the best. And
okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Robert,
thank you very much.
Okay.
Get you guys out to a drag race.
Yeah.
Want to do it.
You should come to Indy.
Okay, good.
Come to Indy. Yeah.
Chip, our director, is working on getting his guest coming into the show here.
Yeah, I love that, Robert, describing that whole thing, and it's, you know, it's like 4 seconds, you know?
I know, but I had no idea that they get slammed with another G-load halfway down the track. I never knew that.
-4.
And -4 at the end. Well, I knew the chute was a big jolt.
Wow, that's just awesome.
Like 4 Gs, just bang.
One of my favorite parts of this webcast is we got Leonard Wood of the famous Wood Brothers to come on over and sit down with us and talk for Out of Line After Hours.
Oh, my gosh. Now we got history here.
The line bomb now.
Leonard, John McElroy. What a pleasure to meet you.
Here, let me put up.
We got Leonard Wood from the Wood Brothers, the original Wood Brothers. So we're going out live right now over the web, and we'll have a lot of people catching the podcast on this in the days to come as well. But just fantastic having you here.
Well, it's like I said before, to be honored by the Henry Ford after all these years is just, that's just as good as it gets. I mean,
and you've been affiliated with Ford for 60 years.
Yeah, well, we've never run nothing but Ford products, and never raced anything with Ford products, and then we've been with Ford Motor Company since 56, you know, is when they started supporting us, you know.
Yeah. So tell us about when you went to Indy with Jimmy Clark. Did you have much time to spend with the car before you were asked to do that, or did you just show up and say, figure it out?
No, you see, we already had it worked out in the cup cars, you know, in the NASCAR racing. And so Ford Motor Company wanted us to come up and pit Clark. So we will go up a week ahead. And, you know, you go in this is a foreign shop, and you want to know, is these guys going to accept us or not? But they welcomed us with open arms. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
But they was glad we were there, and so we had the whole week to prepare the car.
Yeah.
And I remember we was going through inspection, and we had this giant vent here in the tank, you know. Well, the outlet was going to have to come off of the bottom about that far for this round, big round vent here. But what that does, you know, is streamlines the fuel out of the tank into the lines. And so anyway, we said, well, you know, it's just up there. But all we was interested in getting through inspection. And he says, I'll bet you $1,000 you can't pour 20 gallons a minute out of that tank. Well, we didn't argue with him. All we wanted to do is go racing, you know. So after it's all said and done, and we went out and made a little practice run, and we put 58 gallons in 15 seconds.
Wow.
And see, this was right after the year before they had pressure.
Yeah.
They put it in under pressure, so everybody thinks we're going to be in there about a minute. So we knew it was going to be under 20 seconds, so the first stop, I think, was 17, 18 seconds. So kind of caught everybody off guard.
So who first approached you to do it? Was it Ford or was it Colin Chapman?
Ford.
Yeah.
Ford, yeah.
They said, what are you guys doing Memorial Day weekend? You want to come up and help us out?
Yeah, we hit a home run for sure, you know, and got the most publicity we ever got in our life in the least amount of time.
How many stops did you do that day?
Just like? 2.
Two stops? The whole 500?
Oh, yeah. The commentator, Sam Hanks, he was commentating that day, and we came in, and they says, well, you can bet they didn't get it full, you know, green crew and all that. So said he'd be coming back in, so we never come back in, and he sent a runner down to see if we were burning half gasoline and half alcohol, but he was running pure alcohol. But the schedule was we would do the normal stop, and two stops is what it would be. And if it's anything out of the ordinary, then we'd let his crew go. But it worked out really well. I told Clark, I says, now you, it's important you stop
where
it's marked, or the hoses won't reach, or it'll buckle the hoses. And he says, you just tell me where you want to stop. He put it right on the money. Then, of course, when we left, I was on the far side. I released my hose, and I'm leaping back. He's moving forward as I'm leaping back. It all worked out great. It was a special event and very exciting.
Yeah. So you've had some of the greatest NASCAR drivers in history drive for you. You can't tell us who your favorite was, but I imagine David Pearson was.
Well, he won the most races, and we had so many world greatest it's ever been.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you just name them, you know, Pearson, Ford, Gurney, Parnelli, Curtis Turner, Cale Yarborough. I don't want to leave anybody out.
Right.
But they was all great, and they all had a little different quality, you know. It's something a little different.
Gurney at Riverside, I mean, that must have been special.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
he smoked everybody.
And the farther he went, the faster he got, because he kept... He would work on it to do it right, not to overdo it. And if you overdo it, you're going to run slower. So, but Ford, I always got a kick out of picking at Ford, and we got along great with Ford. But Pearson, he was just, we had him the longest, and he was just great to set a car up for, you know, the way he drove it.
And he was so smart.
Very tactical.
Yeah, he knew how to do it, and the way he drove, you could set the car up so it would roll free through the corner. And that's where you gain your speed. I mean, the guy drives it in there too hard, and you got to put extra weight in, it keeps spinning out, and then it settles down, it's pushing, see, and it don't roll free, you know. So, but it's been a great 60 years. I mean, like I said, Glenn, he was really, we had a lot of fun with him himself, my brother Glenn. But we've just had the greatest drivers in the world.
Well, this is a special award that you got here.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, I used to just think about, it'd be so great to get hooked up with Ford Motor Company, you know, and then for them to come on board and then us be associated with them all these years, it's just, that's the top, that's as good as it gets.
The Wood Brothers were always known early on for having such great pit stops. Was there a tipping moment in NASCAR when the different teams really started
maybe
to put an effort into really figuring out how to do pit stops faster? And how did you go about doing that?
Well, in 1960, Fireball Roberts, Smokey Unic, you know, they was the top of the game, you know, and they took like 45 seconds to change two tires and gas. So we started working on it in 1960, the next race, the fall race. And pretty soon we was down to 25 seconds. And then, you know, you just keep, you know, where is your weakest length, you know, you just improve that area, you know. Well, okay, we got the tires off and on, but can't get the jack up quick enough. So you speed the jack up. Now we're getting the tires changed quick. Now
can't
get the gas in. So you improve the fuel flow, you know, to where it...
They're going to let me join some famous people.
Oh, gosh.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
They're trying to put me on an airplane for Englishtown.
Yeah, we won't keep you long, John.
Tonight we've got John Forrest joining us as well. John McElroy, it's a pleasure to meet
McElroy?
You. Yeah.
Peter DiLorenzo, nice to meet you, John.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Hey, congratulations to you for this award.
I'll tell you what, this guy here, I mean, he just knows how it's done.
I'm still learning.
Well, no,
the kids are teaching me now.
Yeah, that's what you say. But
John's the man, and John, you've been hot again this year. How's it feel?
you know, with all what we've been through, and I was talking, you know, to racing here in America, the museum, Henry Ford Museum, that I really think the history that they're going to tell, and we've been a part of it. We lost Eric Medlin in 07, and it was the engineers here at Ford that really put us back together. We were all about going fast and winning championships, and if you broke it, you fixed it and drug another one out. And then when you lose somebody, you know, it's a wake-up call. And, you know, Eric's dad, John Medlin, was the Eric Medlin project that we have in Indy. His dad was really the head of that and created that. But it was the Ford engineers that worked with him that I give credit that saved my life. Am I even talking now?
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking.
When I crashed 4 months later, you know, I broke my arms and legs.
Right.
And I wouldn't be here today.
Well, put that on.
When that car went in half. So the good Lord must have kept me around for something. Can you hear me? I never say anything worth hearing anyway.
So you're running well again this year. How does that feel?
Feels good. You know, when you've struggled so many years, after 30 years in this sport, to get 33 years to get there, and then all of a sudden they take it all away from you because your legs and arms don't work. And then in this economy, when sponsors want you to produce, you know, it's what we do. But the young kids, Robert finished, won the championship last year with NHRA, driving for Auto Club. The Mustang, Ashley, was number two, and the old man was in the cellar. And so bought my way back. We're 1, 2, and 3 right now, so no complaints. Safety is right up there with winning. And but I'm excited here to be here in the museum.
Yeah.
The guys like this, the Woods brothers. No, it's a fact. And you know what was most fun today for my daughters, Ashley's here, and Courtney, that wants to go pro like her sister.
Yeah.
I always want them to be like me. She wants to be like her sister. And that's a good thing. But to let them be a part of NHRA, not just about race cars or sponsorship, but to be a part of, you know, what America was all about.
Yeah.
The automobile, to me, is what I live for. And let them see, this museum. I was just hoping they get to see Edsel. Edsel, I just love it. He educates me. I've been getting between Mullally and Fields and Farley and Zube, I've been getting a real education.
I bet you have.
And I'm learning. I'm adapting.
I tell you what, I just love to hear you speak. I mean, you just come across so good. I mean, you're such a competitive person. And it's just a joy to see you on TV, you know, when you run these races and you win. And, man, you just... It shows.
He's embarrassing me.
he's just a great promoter and showman. I mean, it just use what the show is all about.
Thank you. NHRA has been good to me. The fans are unbelievable. You know, we were out there today on the road course, and the people working at Ford, they're like fans of yours. And that was another thing. My kids got to be a part of that.
Yeah.
To drive that road. Of course, I'm out there, and you know, in the Ford Fusion, I'm going 10 miles an hour, and the old NASCAR guys are going by me, see if they can tip them over. But to have my girls part of that, and come over here, and
did they get to drive the cars?
Oh yeah, they're out there
wonderful.
Racing.
Wonderful.
Oh, they're out there racing. They're loving it. My little one, she said, "Ride with me, Dad." We got that old high-powered Ford Mustang with 6 speeds, and she's flying. I said, "You get out here, and if we lose a tire, I'll be back in the hospital again." But no, they just, the kids think, boy, they're just fearless.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I am too on race day. But out here, when I'm testing, oh no.
You know, you can't have won as many champs as you have and not be fearless, John. So.
Oh yeah, but I'm a.
Now you have perspective. So.
Oh boy. Yeah. I know what it's like to wake up in a helicopter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And. You know, well, I was just going to say, Jack Roush took me a ride in his little old Cobra one time. And I mean, it took off so fast that I couldn't focus my eyes. And I can't imagine what it feels like the way you do it.
Five G's out of the hole.
How in the world can you stand this tremendous acceleration?
Well, you drink a lot of coffee in the morning.
I'm telling you.
It's 4 to 5 G's, but... You know, we're a little different than NASCAR. You know what I mean? I always said if I was in NASCAR, had to drive around for 3 hours, I'd have to have rest stops. So I could sleep. And drag racing, You know?
No, it doesn't take long, does it?
Kind of like sex. Only takes me 4 or 5 seconds. Wait a minute. Is this MTV? They told me MTV.
No, it's plenty good here.
Cut that. But I really love it. I'm a big fan of NASCAR and IndyCar. I watched the race, you know, the 500 and seeing the names. And I'm a race car driver. I'm an owner, but I'm a fan.
Yeah.
You know, I get all giggly. I get around you and Roush, and I get over there. Then I see the Ford General Zube comes by. I stand at attention. Yeah. Terrified. My knees are knocking like the cowardly lion. I'm afraid to move.
Alan Mulally will give you a run for your money, too. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And you mentioned those other series. Drag racing is holding its own fan-wise, ratings-wise, comparably speaking. Why is that?
We're NASCAR's little brother. We're nothing of that magnitude, but we got a pretty good chunk, and it's a great buy, NHRA drag racing. And the fans can be one-on-one with you at the races.
Yeah.
They can watch you race, and they can watch you fist fight in the pits. We do that too, me and Tony Pendragon. But at the end of the day, they get to see all of that. And I think just in the economy, our sponsorship is nothing like NASCAR's. You know what I'm saying? Because of the difference in the cost of running these cars.
Right.
So, well-deserved for NASCAR. But at the end of the day, for some reason, we didn't get hit as hard in the seat count in the stands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we're holding our own, maybe because we were small and still trying to catch Big Brother. That's the only thing I can say, because we've been out there a long time. But we keep our noses clean, we race, and we put on a good show for the fans.
One thing impresses me is, like you said, you get to walk through the behind the cars, and when you're warming those cars up, you know, I really love to listen to engines. That's my thing. You know, I really like a good sounding engine. And when you warm that thing up, and then all of a sudden you just crack the throttle, it just takes your breath. I mean, it's this.
Yeah.
The smell of that nitromethane.
You just feel all that sound and the horsepower. It's just.
You feel it in your chest.
Yeah, it's just awesome. The quickness of it is when you wrap that thing, it's just like a stick of dynamite.
And when you hit the wall, you feel it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Please cut the. It's kind of like sense. Cut that. I think I've had too much Red Bull today. Full throttle. Oh, stay with the series sponsor. At the end of the day, up here with Ford, we had a meeting this morning. And it was interesting for the fuel cars that I drive, talking about inflated seat belts, side impact. You know, they put the little black box, blue boxes on the cars because of, you know, head damage. They checked me out after my crash. Nope, he's the same. Nothing changed. But in all of that, it was so impressive that they're always thinking what they'll put in the flex or the edge or the Lincoln or whatever, all that technology they get from NASCAR and they get from drag racing. But it really is cool that the things that they're coming up with to keep our cars, if they start wheels standing, what we can do to get them back on the ground so you don't have a blowover, things that can save your life. And I like that. And they're investing, because for so many years, you know, drag racing was here, and we just ran crazy and tried to win.
Yeah.
And now these engineers, and they're loving it. They come to the races like they do in NASCAR, and they're investing money, even in this economy, when money's tough. You know what I mean? And when you know your place is when the boss up at the top says, you're going before me, so you better get your deal right. So I think we're back on track, and I like to stay in the game, you know? You know, I really love what I do. I got nowhere to go. The wife won't let me come home. She loves me. She just don't like me.
It sounds like
you really got somewhere to go.
You really got your car hooked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go down to drag and it busts loose and spins, you can't have that. I mean, you got to have it hooked up. And it looks like you got that working in your direction.
I was asked early by some of the Ford execs, you know, why are you doing so good? You know, and some of our teams struggle. I said, that's because I called Roush and said, what do I do to fix it? And he told me. It's just one of them things. Race cars, boy, it's a roller coaster. You know, hero to zero.
Yeah.
And one day you're just good, and I'm just praying to the good Lord that it'll stay and we can keep this momentum. And this economy, we need to do everything for our sponsors.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And everything that we can do to help them, and they're trying to help fund us. And it's an economy where a lot of times A lot of sponsors don't want to spend, so spend money.
Yeah.
So God bless Ford Motor Company for staying by all of us, and we'll just keep preaching the gospel.
Well, John, we know you have to go, but we really appreciate you stopping by.
Well, let me just say, Ford's got a great product. They got great legends. They got great teams. And where we're going to go, who knows? But boy, in the last 4 years, they've turned this company around. Mullally and his generals, and they told me years ago what they were going to do. Be part of the plan or you're out. And it's like, I got a wake-up call, jumped in, got with my people, and we're working for the people that, you know, that started this whole thing. So I just hope we can deliver for them. Hey, congratulations.
Yeah, and certainly a pleasure seeing you again, and good luck, and enjoy watching you race. You got a great...
World's greatest speaker right here. Thank you.
Thanks,
don't
John.
Don't need a rush. They're going to get me on a plane for anytime.
Yeah.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Leonard, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Leonard, what a pleasure. Oh, terrific having you here.
As John Forrest and Leonard Wood headed out to go catch an airplane, we were then joined by Bob Taska III. The Taska family has been involved in car dealerships and racing for a lot of years.
So tell us about your family's relationship with Ford. It's been a long, long time, right?
It's been a long time. You know, my grandfather started back in the early 60s. He actually started in the sixth grade. He wrote a term paper on what he wanted to do when he grew up, and it was to be a Ford dealer. And in the sixth grade, he knew what he wanted to be. He started out as a mechanic, worked his way up, ultimately ran a store, and then ended up with a Ford franchise. And the rest is history. You know, he's.
And you invested heavily in the drag racing as a dealer.
Yeah, and his philosophy that he coined was win on Sunday, sell on Monday. And he built, you know, the cornerstone of his business and his relationship with Ford, for that matter, on racing and drag racing and racing on Sunday, selling the cars they raced on Monday. And then the sport evolved, and you know, it got away from him in the early 70s, and he got out of it because he wasn't selling the cars he was racing. And it kind of turned him off. And I think what I was so proud of is that he had the opportunity to see us kind of reinvent Win on Sunday, Sell on Monday with our program with Motorcraft and Quick Lane, because, you know, that saying is alive and well. Clearly, we don't sell the cars that we drive on Sunday.
Right.
But it's the platform, it's the marketing platform that we engage the fans, we engage the B2B, the Motorcraft distributors and customers, and really drive business for Ford Motorcraft and Quick Lane. So that's what I'm excited about. We got a great hot rod that wins on Sunday, and you know, my grandfather's vision of selling on Monday is alive and well.
And how is your, you still have a big dealership enterprise?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We have two Ford and Lincoln Mercury dealerships, one in Cranston, Rhode Island, and one in Massachusetts.
Right.
And, you know, thank goodness the worst is behind us. And, you know, sales are picking up. Obviously, Ford is having a tremendous year with, you know, some of the greatest products we've had in our showroom floor in my lifetime. So it's an exciting time, both behind the wheel of one of these things and back at the dealership in the showroom.
So you're involved in the dealer, too, on day-to-day?
Yeah, I'm very involved more on the fixed operations side, which ties in well with Motorcraft and Quick Lane. So when I'm speaking to the dealers, I can relate in a way that a typical race driver can't relate, because when I'm not racing, I'm back at the dealership. But got a big family, cousins and brothers and sisters that really pick up all the pieces day to day, and I give them all the credit for the dealership, and we're going to keep this hot rod Ford Mustang running on the racetrack.
Right.
You mentioned that the racing is the platform for the brand, marketing the brand. Obviously, Mustang's going to be high on the fans list, but what other products can you market via racing?
Well, it's a great question. NHRA really has unparalleled access for the fans to the teams, but also for the sponsors to the fans. And we do a variety of things. It's really a three-pronged approach. First, the B2B side, the business-to-business side, with Motorcraft distributors and Quick Lane dealers and Quick Lane prospects. You can get them to a race. Hospitality is right next to the race car. Very engaging opportunity. Immerse them in the brand, what we're all about. Thank them for their business if it's a customer of a Motorcraft distributor. So that's the B2B. Then you have, you know, the B2C, where we're connecting with the consumer directly, and that's through the Midway, where we're capturing data and hand raisers and interest, so we can market back Quick Lane specials, Motorcraft specials, and Ford specials. And then lastly, I call it emotional marketing. It's what we do on the racetrack. And for me, that's been so humbling that you can connect to so many people.
Don't miss that plane.
I won't. I'm right behind you.
We're getting them out of here real quick.
Race on Sunday, sell on Monday. Grandpa Tasker.
He tweaked it a little bit. Win on Sunday, sell on Monday. But no, John, that's a relationship that dates back to the late 90s where we introduced John to Ford. And, you know, he has become such a mentor of mine, growing my program. And we made that big announcement, the One Ford announcement in Charlotte, where we brought our teams together from a technology standpoint. And it's been a wonderful opportunity for me. I mean, hey, I'm living my dream representing a sponsor that I grew up with as a kid.
Yeah.
And, I've always said I was the all Ford kid in an all Ford hot rod. And, with John's help and Ford's help, we got an all Ford engine, every piece of it, for the first time this weekend in Englishtown, New Jersey. So I'm looking forward to getting to Englishtown.
That's great. Well, we're really glad you stopped by.
Great to stop by. Thank you for having me on.
And
stay tuned. We're going to try to put our Mustang in the winner's circle this
weekend.
We'll
be watching.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Christian, John Eckhart. Christian Overland.
So introduce yourself for the audience who's watching live right now.
Christian Overland, a vice president of the Henry Ford. Welcome to Henry Ford Museum.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a cool place. I mean, I don't know how old though I was. The first time I came here, probably 6 years old.
Yeah, it's a terrific place. It's a lot of memories for people. I run into so many people that have been here when they're in the third grade or the fourth grade, and they come back and say, a few things have changed, but do you guys still make those nail rings?
Well, everybody remembers the giant locomotive, too.
Absolutely.
That thing is
Allegheny, one of the largest steam locomotives in the world. The apex of steam. You know, in the 40s, that was just coming up, and that was the pinnacle when the diesel was coming up, too.
So tell us about Racing in America exhibit.
Well, the Racing in America exhibit is a terrific idea of racing innovation. Our concept is to tell the stories about racing innovation in America using the wonderful, compelling stories of innovators, such as going back to Henry Ford and his sweepstakes, 1901. He and Spider Huff, one of his mechanics, worked with a dentist to actually get some porcelain around an insulator and created what was the modern-day spark plug. It was enough spark to keep the engine from fouling and allowed
Spider
him...
Spider Huff was involved in that?
Spider Huff.
No kidding.
Yeah. Spider Huff hung off the side of that in order to keep the, I think, going around the track when Henry Ford was racing against Alexander Witt, and Spider Huff hung on the side, keeping that down. So that's where it started for Ford Motor Company. It was a great innovation. We're telling these innovations all the way forward to the Hans device, track barrier safety, the current things that are being done in NHRA that John Forrest is working on. It's going to be truly amazing.
Now, Peter and I love this sort of thing, but why? Why would the Henry Ford Museum do this? Of course, it's Henry Ford and all, but are there that many people who visit the museum that will be interested in racing?
That's a great question. There's 1.6 million people that come to our campus each year.
Unreal. And the idea,
yeah,
That's a lot of people.
It is. But the fascinating thing is they're all looking for a pathway in the past. And what we've found is if you can connect them to something that's relevant to their daily life, they're really excited about it. And our model of learning is if you get them through the heart, visceral, and get them emotionally connected, it opens up the intellectual side. So racing is all about emotion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very exciting. It's very compelling. But thinking about innovation in America, there's a need today. Thinking about critical skills for the 21st century, problem solving, critical thinking, collaboration, teamwork, that's what American racing is all about. So if you tell the story in that way, it allows people to create a better pathway for all of us. That's why we're doing it.
Way cool. Oh,
that's great.
Hey, and David Welch is with us now. David, good having you in here.
It's been just.
Hi, David.
Good. So what all cars are you going to have here? Because when you talk about American racing, you guys have got classic race cars from all over the world. Peter and I were talking before the show. You've got one of Fangio's Grand Prix cars, Mercedes, from the 1950s. But I imagine that's not American, so that would not be in the exhibit.
That's correct. That actually is in Europe now. That's actually in the Mercedes Museum.
Oh. Really?
That's right.
Is it still your car? Or is it
no,
theirs?
It's the Mercedes. We gave it to them, deaccessioned it so it could go in that museum. Mm-hmm. When they built their museum over in Europe, it was one of the pieces that really needed to build that collection. So we were proud to work with them to get that there. But going to your question, what are the great American race cars? So, again, starting with sweepstakes, 1901, old 16. Not many people know the story, but the Vanderbilt Cup was the road race in Long Island before the Indianapolis 500, right? In 1906, a locomobile built this car, and George Robinson drove it in 1908 to be the first American to win. That car never was restored, never painted, and has all its patina. It still operates today. And so it's a great story of American ingenuity. Bill Elliott's Talladega, you know, the Thunderbird. Buck Baker's Chrysler 300B from the 1950s when he dominated the race in 56. And then we're actually telling news stories as well, too. So we're going to be pulling in current racing innovations.
That is way cool. And when does it all open up?
Well,
still a couple of years away,
well,
I would imagine.
Yeah, what we need to do is secure $15 million in pledges.
Oh, well, that's
so
all.
If we can do that, then we can start building. That's 18 months out. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're doing is we're making part of the collection come alive. So one of the most famous Indy cars is the Lotus 38, built by Ford Motor Company, Colin Chapman. That's over in England now. It's being restored by Colin's son, Clive, and it's premiering at the Goodwood Festival of Speed for the first time running since 1965.
That's awesome.
And Sir Jackie Stewart's driving it.
Oh, man.
So Jimmy Clark won the race in 1965. Now another Scott, a famous Scott's driving it, so appropriate.
That's great.
And then it comes back to America in our into our museum.
Well, we wish you the best with all of this.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Really great having you on here.
Thank you. Follow our progress at racinginamerica.com.
Okay, cool.
Take care.
Glad you got that.
Pleasure to meet you.
From talking about collections within the Henry Ford Museum, we then went to the other extreme. Our next guest was Von Gittin, a professional drifter in formula drifting.
Formula drifter?
Oh, okay, cool. Come on in.
How you doing?
Doing well, Von. John McElroy.
Nice to meet you. Yeah,
I saw you last July at Road America doing your thing at Road America.
Okay, cool, at the Historics.
Yeah.
They will be out there again today, or this year.
That was great.
Yeah, good time.
You have too much fun.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah,
it's tough out there burning tires. I know.
Pure drudgery, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. That's the fun stuff. The demos are fun. Competition's pretty intense.
Yeah.
But
so just in case people didn't get it, Von Gittin. Did I say that right?
Von Gittin Jr. Okay, yes.
And drifter extraordinaire, huh?
Yep. I am a professional drifter. I run in the Formula Drift Series, which is America's premier series of drifting.
What do some of the courses?
We do Road America, we do Irwindale Speedway, we do Infineon, we do a couple tracks. We do a track in Seattle, we do Wall Speedway.
And you're doing the entire track or just...
The judges choose a section. So drifting is very audience-centered, right? So we pick a section of like 5 to 6 turns that... we can build a stadium setting around, and that is the section that we're judged on in the course. For instance, an oval course, we'll do a large one side of the bank, and then we'll do something in the infield as well.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize. I thought you just did demos at Road America. You run up there, too?
Road Atlanta.
Oh, Road Atlanta.
Yeah, we've never done a competition at Road America. I'd like to, though. That's a fun track.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, the big one of the last turns. Mm-hmm. I forget what number it is, but... For me, it's fourth gear, just pin. Yeah, it's huge sweeper.
Carousel?
Right-hander carousel, yeah. So much fun.
Yeah, that's a...
It's pretty nuts.
Yeah.
So what got you into it all? Why drifting? Why not some other form of racing?
Drifting to me is, I've always been a child of action sports, a product of action sports, skateboarding, freestyle motocross, BMX. And drifting for me was... a way of self-expression behind the wheel of a car. It's a lot of fun. It has a lot of components of racing aside from the checkered flag. We have full-blown amazing race cars. We're chasing traction. We're chasing all the bike we can get. 750 horsepower in a 2,500-pound car.
That'll get it.
So you're running 2011 Mustang?
Yeah, 2011 Mustang. We got a Ford Racing 5-liter in it, and it's... It's just unbelievable.
Do you run racing gasoline?
Oh, yeah. We run 116 octane. The whole body of the car is carbon fiber. And we get a car from Ford and beautiful brand new 2011 and buzzsaw it and cut it from the shocks back.
You could have done a 2,500 pounds. You must chop out a lot.
Yeah, it's really cut down. But, there's a lot of, the really cool thing about drifting is, a lot of it's driver. There's a lot of team aspects that come into it now, but we're running, one of my teammates has an 1,800-pound car with 600 horsepower. So, it's pretty open. So there's a lot of engineering going into it. And,
so there's an engineering contest to a degree. I like this more standardized professional racing.
Yeah, absolutely. It used to not be. You know, I've been doing this for about 8 years. So, I mean, I built my first car in my garage. And, you know, you still see a lot of people doing that in the at the amateur ranks, just like you do with any other kind of racing. But at the pro level, you know, we're bringing in, you know, there's a lot of top men teams coming out there, a lot of guys coming from other sports and other demeanors from both drivers and engineers. And it's really neat to see it evolving and you know, being really more accepted in the mainstream.
So what other sponsors do you have? I mean, obviously you have Ford, but what else do you have?
Monster Energy and Falcon Tire. Are my two largest sponsors.
Are you have the similar paint job from last year? Because I remember the Falcon Tire paint job.
Yeah, what we did actually, we took the Scallop style.
Yeah.
And we made the front black and the back white.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's, you know, Monster, you know, they're kind of sharing the livery. Looks really cool. Our competition car is, the whole car is carbon. So all we did was clear the carbon. So the whole front of the car is raw carbon showing and the back's painted. So. It's definitely really cool, you know, and you know, to be out here and hanging out with, you know, all the Cup drivers and NHRA drivers, you know, the mutual respect that we all have is really neat, you know, and those guys really get it, you know, Carl Edwards and Greg Biffle and even Bob Tasker, like, man, I need to come out to one of those events, you know, we got to go for a ride. And I'm like, I want to put you on the car and let you all drive and check it out because right. It's addicting, man. I mean, you know what I mean? It goes against everything they've ever learned, and I've got a lot of guys that do road racing, and I've tried it, and it's just a different mindset.
Yeah.
Challenging, both are challenging, just different. So it's really neat to see those guys get behind the wheel.
And drifting has an element of subjective, right? I mean, it's style points as well as just getting through everything.
Right. Well, yeah, it's basically the criteria we're judged on line, which is running a proper line, right? Speed, obviously, we have two speed guns throughout the course, so they judge speed two ways. Angle, which is how sideways you are, and then also overall impact. So, you know, how nuts did it look? And that's the least of the score, but it is a variable.
Drifting started with basically a bunch of kids in their hot rods, right?
Drifting started in the mountains of Japan when the guys in Japan would go gripping through the mountains. And they started going so fast that they would literally be sliding through the mountains. And then all of a sudden, instead of gripping to the mountains, they just went up to just slide around. And that's how drifting started. And then somebody turned it into a professional sport in Japan. America got wind of it, fell in love with it.
That's history.
No.
It's kind of a silly question maybe, but as a full-time driver in drifting, can this be your full-time job? Can you make enough cash doing that to...
Fortunately, I have been able to.
I mean, it's nice work if you can get it. Right?
Yeah, I was in IT, and my IT job afforded me my hobby 7 years ago. And I used to just pay my mortgage and work on my car and go out and have fun. And as the sport grew, you know, I learned the business and learned how to, you know, carry myself in a professional.
I've seen it on TV. Is it regularly covered on television now?
Yeah, we're on the Versus channel the last 2 years. We were on Speed, and then we moved over to Versus. And
Versus is doing a lot of good stuff with racing, is my opinion.
Yeah, they are.
I really like their indie coverage a lot. I thought it's been pretty good.
Yeah, they really are doing cool stuff. So we're very glad to be over there. And, you know, the internet is so huge for us. So the impressions are there, for our sponsors to justify being involved. So. You know, it's we're selling out every place we're at, over 10,000 people. I mean, it's just really, really, really cool. I mean, it's not Cup, but it's there.
Yeah.
We always like to see someone having fun around cars. So. And you definitely are.
Absolutely.
That's great to have you here. I'm glad you stopped by.
Well, I appreciate y'all having me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark. Great. Best of luck to you.
Meet you. Best of luck. Right.
See ya.
Have fun in that boring job.
Yeah, I'm trying my best.
Next up, we had somebody who we've had on the show before, Jamie Allison, the head of Ford Racing.
So our viewers may remember Jamie, who's been on the show before.
Yeah, how long ago was that?
It was months ago, but I think it was winter.
This year.
It was winter.
Yeah.
Right.
The director of Ford Racing.
Yes, thank you. And 6 months on the job. Still working.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
She must have just started when we had you on the show.
Yeah.
It was very early.
Yeah. So Jack says you guys are going to be on point this weekend at Michigan. What do you think?
Whatever Jack says, I'm all over it. I mean, somebody was telling me, I guess the track is called the house that Jack built. I mean, we've had 31 wins in Ford. Jack has won 11 times, and the Wood Brothers won 11 times. So the odds are pretty well stacked. Now we just gotta come through it now. I mean, in NASCAR, we know we have a systemic area that we're working on, which is with no testing in the last couple of years. It put an overemphasis on simulation tools, and our simulations, need some tweaking. Yeah. We haven't been predictive and correlative, which is if you're not predictive, you're chasing it all day long, and that's the condition.
See, that's what I find so fascinating is, NASCAR is regarded, I think, with some justification as being sort of retro tech in the vehicle itself.
Yep.
But what you're talking about is being able to simulate everything.
Absolutely. Simulate
the entire race before you get to the track.
Yeah, well, as Jamie, as we've noticed, the last 3 years in the NASCAR garage, you see Formula One mechanics.
Crew chiefs, technical directors.
So, I mean, you're seeing all of these people in NASCAR garage, and they're doing it all in the simulation game, right?
Yeah, I mean, that act at the end of 2008 when NASCAR banned testing, those who were able to apply the technology of simulation and get ahead of the game, because you couldn't test, you had to predict, and those with the better simulation techniques were able to quickly jump on it. You know what? We know what the issue is. We got a plan, and we'll get to it.
In terms of making your models better.
Yeah. We started a couple years ago with a simple ride model, because that was kind of an early advent of simulation, because you can predict at long tracks how the car will behave. Well, now you have to advance your game to a handling model, which takes in the geometry of the car, it takes in the aero, it takes in all types of elements that you have to all put together and predict how that setup will behave at that track. Well, if you're off, you unload, you go out, and you'll know for the first time whether you're right or not. And you qualify, you don't qualify well, and in race setup, you're constantly chasing it during pit stops. So it's not a good way to really be ahead of your game. So
especially in NASCAR, where the field is separated by thousands of seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I've also been paying a little attention to pro stock. And in pro stock, if you're off by a thousandth of a second, you don't make the field. They're all, between 1 and 16, they're separated by a thousandth of a second. And NASCAR's hundreds of seconds. And the room for error is not very high.
Not there. I went out and visited Pratt and Miller. What they were telling me is when they do testing now, all they're doing, their real-world physical testing, is to verify the simulation model.
You're spot on, John. Is that, and that's the missing gap for us, is that without a validation, and the only validation is at the track during racing, that's not very good.
That's too late.
Because the next one, you move on to the next track. And whether you got a short track, you got a bank track, you got a big track, so all of a sudden, the variability of the track keeps you behind. So it's pretty systemic, pretty deep, and we know we got that tackled, and we have our engines are the oldest engines, old architecture, and if they don't run very cool, you can't really then tape the front of the car to create more downforce, and that's what we're lacking is grip. So now we got new engines, they cool better. Now I said, tape them shut.
Get that nose down
and let's go.
So we'll be watching this weekend. So tell the viewers what car you have. You have a Mustang.
Oh, yeah. It's,
tell them what you ordered.
I'm one of those lucky guys. Work at the company, work in racing, so I kind of, I can have my cake and eat it too. So I ordered a 5-liter Mustang, and we had that Daytona 500 pace car edition. Well, we had limited edition, 50 units. Well, what kind of, we created it. I'm like, well, if we create it, I can put one on my car.
Yeah.
So I'm driving around in a 1 of 50 Daytona 500 pace car edition. So
cool.
It's got all the look, and it's,
Convertible.
Convertible, yeah. It's a stunner.
What's the horsepower in yours?
Well, the car comes with 412 horsepower. I don't have it on my car, but we have a blower that you can put on a 5-liter and get you 100 horsepower. But I'm just methodically working my way through the packs that we have. So I lowered the car, stiffened up the car, and then basically changed some of the electronics in the car to get a little more feedback in the car. So I'm enjoying it.
I'll bet. Good.
Yep. So,
just in case the viewers out there wonder if the people involved in this business are enthusiasts,
They are. They all exactly right.
And if you live in the local area and you see a red convertible with the Daytona 500 pace car edition, blow by.
It's you. Yeah.
Sorry, I just had a long day. I just wanted to blow some steam.
Cool.
Well, Jamie, thanks so much for coming by again. Jamie. Oh, it's been terrific having you.
It's a treat. Thank you for talking with me.
Good to see you.
And, wish us well this weekend.
Yes.
We will. Okay.
All the best this weekend.
All right, thank you.
To our viewers, Nate Ryan covers motorsports for USA Today. I consider him one of the best in the business at what he does. And he knows it all, and he fills us in on a weekly basis.
Sometimes you fill me in, actually, here. Probably a lot more often than I fill you in on things. Yeah.
I always like when you venture off from – you're on the NASCAR beat, and which you do really well.
Thanks.
But I always like when you venture off to other racing things.
Me too. I got to write about Le Mans today, which
Let's
was –
zip your mic up a little higher. I think it'll be bit better. Yeah, a lot of racing this weekend.
Le Mans.
Canadian Grand Prix. Mm-hmm.
Which one are you going to?
Michigan. Sadly, I'm going to this one. I'm just kidding. Not sadly. I mean, I'm blessed to have a job.
Well, you get
like
to
this.
See the new media room, the new press.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots to see at the track. But yeah, no, you're right, Peter. I mean, it's nice to be able to have a job that affords me the opportunity not just to cover stock cars, because as you and I have talked about, it's almost become, you know, monolithic coverage sometimes of racing, where it's just racing is synonymous with NASCAR, and really there's so much else.
Well,
to
I mean, I think people really in this racing business, and John, you know this too, it's the personalities that make the sport. I mean, there is the racing and the mechanicals, but it's the personalities. It's Joey Logano going off on Happy Harvick and, last week. He had a great line, though. I got it.
Yeah, it's the quote of the year so far.
Well, Joey is, what, 21?
20.
20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's unbelievable. But and he and Kevin Harvick have been kind of agitating against each other, right?
Well, Harvick took him out.
Well, they've had a history, right?
Yeah,
I mean, most recently, it was Harvick who was the more aggressive.
But Joey had the great line after, and I don't know if I could get it right. Do you remember the line?
It was... he said he didn't blame Harvick because his wife wears the fire suit in the family and tells him what to do. Which had a kernel of truth to it, because Delina Harvick, Kevin Harvick's wife, does wear a fire suit for every race.
She's the only wife who does, right?
Yeah, as far as we know.
Yeah.
At least in plain sight.
Yeah, and because Delina's very much partnered up with Kevin and running their enterprises, and I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then she responded, they've got a t-shirt on their website, and now it'll be cool. It's fine.
Well, that's what, you know, NASCAR, to their credit, has figured out. You know, that it was about the personalities. That was how to drive the popularity.
Let them get agitated.
Yeah.
And don't try to sanitize them or homogenize them anymore.
Right. Right.
So, what stories are you thinking are going to be big this weekend?
Well, I think, you know, number one, not just because we're here, but I think Ford. That's what I wrote about for tomorrow's paper. I think they're a big story coming in here with all nine teams running the new engine, with just the surprising lack of success they've had. I mean, they've been solid, but I think a lot of people thought, well, NASCAR being cyclical, after you have a down 2009, 2010, they'll come right out of the box and do well.
When's the last time Ford won?
Not this
November,
year, right?
Yeah, November of last year. And if you go prior to that, I mean, Jamie McMurray won at Talladega in November of last year, but prior to that, you have to go all the way back to the first two races of 2009.
Ken
so, one victory in, I think, 48 races.
What's the problem? Technology.
I think it's their simulation programs is what, you know, what we heard from Jamie this week, and Jack Roush echoed that they just, the testing ban has really hurt them, where they can't validate the results that they get on the computers anymore, and for whatever reason, their computers aren't as accurate for unloading the cars as the other manufacturers.
So are you covering any road races this year? Hope
to get to maybe Petit Le Mans come fall. If not, maybe just go and see a test. I've never been to a sports car event, period. So
see if you can get your guys to send you to Road America for the American LMS race of Road America.
I'd like to do that.
August.
I'd like to do that. We need to get the Cup Series there is what we need to do, Peter.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
No,
I have never been. No.
So
Now, we've talked about this too. Road America is hosting a nationwide race next weekend.
Oh, I did not know that.
Which is going to be very interesting because I think the drivers will come back and say, yeah, we need to run here. And, I know, Nate, you and I have talked about one scenario is they're going to add a road race to the chase, but it'll be an additional road race. They have Infineon, Sears Point, and they've got Watkins Glen. So I kind of think this is testing the waters next weekend nationwide, don't you?
Yeah, I would think so. And, I mean, you know better than anybody, Peter. I mean, that's one of the great venues in this country that just doesn't really get appreciated as much as it probably should.
And if they have a sprint cup race at Road America, there'll be 100,000 people. It'll be huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, the track always gets a great turnout. It's got so much heritage to it.
Well, yeah, and then NASCAR. So the NASCAR teams will go there next weekend and report back, and I'm sure they'll be glowing reviews.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, NASCAR also met with their drivers and their owners this past week, as they did a year ago with these town hall meetings that they're having now. And one of the things they discussed was, what can we do with the chase? And I'm sure that's something was addressed, Peter, was, you know,
because they have too many similar tracks.
You got 4 mile and a half tracks that are, you know, as they say, cookie cutter versions of each other. So, yeah.
Who do you think's going to win this weekend?
It's a tough question.
Joe Gibbs Racing.
I guess your money would have to be on Kyle Busch or Denny Hamlin right now, the way those guys have run.
If the Fords are going to win, it's going to be this weekend.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah. I mean, Michigan has been hugely successful, not just for Roush, but Wood Brothers Racing, you know, who's here with Bill Elliott this weekend. Those two teams are tied for most wins at Michigan with 10 apiece in Cup.
Yeah,
so
they've won here.
Yeah, that home court advantage, you think, would maybe have an impact. We'll see.
So how long have you been on the racing
beat? Full-time about, 6 years now?
Yeah.
The first race I covered was the first race I attended, which probably wouldn't surprise many people who read my stuff. That was California in 1997. So I'm relatively new to it. You know, it's not something I followed all the way through childhood.
So where are you based out of?
Charlotte these days.
Yeah.
Moved down there last year.
I would figure you'd have to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's a natural fit, and not just for NASCAR, but that's where a lot of, you know, Vaughn Gittin Jr., who you had in up here just recently, his team is based a mile and a half from my house. They build the cars for the number one drifting team in America right now. So there's
Penske's consolidated his operation,
right.
So he's got IndyCar and NASCAR in the same shop.
You got some drag racers down there, and Doug Herbert, some other people. So yeah, it really is a mecca.
It is. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. It'd be nice if they can get a Formula One team.
Well, they
took a shot at it. They took a shot at it, and they still got a lot of the. There's a. If anybody wants to buy a shop with about $15 million worth of equipment, I think it goes up for auction this week.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man, that hurts.
That's a shame, but yeah.
Hey, well, thanks so much for stopping by.
Hey,
I really
thanks
appreciate
again.
It. Yeah.
Appreciate you having me. Good to finally meet you in person, Peter. Yeah. Thanks again for your help. Good to meet you.
Earlier in the podcast, we were joined by Leonard Wood, but he was the early generation of Wood Brothers. Next, we've got Len and Eddie Woods, the new generation of Wood Brothers, who were thrilled to be on the program and especially to meet the Auto Extremist.
I've read a lot of your stuff.
Have you?
It's an honor to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
You're not scared.
No. No, you can't go through life that way. It'd be boring.
It would be boring. No, I've read a lot of your work.
Thank you. So how do you guys, you've got such a legacy in the sport. How does it feel to be you guys?
You don't really ever think about it until you come to something like this and have a group of people like yourselves and people that are around, and then it kind of, you know, it kind of gets to you right here.
But
it's just, I guess the biggest honor we have is just being associated with Ford Motor Company for so many years and always racing Ford or Mercury.
Since 1956?
Since 1950, actually.
1950.
Race Fords all along. Daddy started with like a 37 Ford in 1950. And then 56 is when they got factory help.
Yeah,
that's when it began. Daddy used to run on a beach, like in Daytona, years ago.
Yeah,
the beginnings of the sport, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. He sat on pole the last year of the beach.
Wow.
So, and then he ran 1 year at the big speedway, and then he didn't really like the speed, so that's when he started putting other people in his car.
It's fun. So how do you guys... I mean, a lot of people don't know about the technology in NASCAR, and there's a lot of it that people don't see. I mean, right. Casual viewers don't see it. But how have you watched the change in the garage area with the technology over the years? You know, think it's a good thing? Or?
Well, I mean, it's just a product of the time.
It's just
I mean,
the way it is.
It's a different time now. But it happens so gradually. I mean, you look back at it, you think, like, well, 10 years ago, we didn't have data acquisition like we do now. And, you know, much less the simulation programs that everyone's using. But it's kind of a gradual thing, and, you know, you're always looking for the next good thing or the next trick to get your car faster. And you really don't think about it until you stop and look back. And, like, you really don't know how you got there. Yeah. You just got there.
The racing hasn't changed much. You got to be ready when you unload, and if you're not, you're chasing it all weekend.
Right? That's exactly right. That's the hard part. Yeah. We don't have any testing anymore. So
yeah, we were talking to Jamie, and he said that's really affected you guys.
Yeah, and it just that means your simulation packages have to be spot on, because when you unload, that's all you got. I mean, we went to Daytona this year, and as well as last year for the 500. The car had never been on the racetrack until it was unloaded. And fortunately,
why did they
fast.
Do that, by the way? I mean, I need to be caught up to speed a little bit on that, but why did they sort of basically computer simulated?
Well, it was kind of a product of not testing.
Testing was done to save cost, allegedly,
money,
right?
So everybody economic times, it's a good track. Thing.
In the bad economic times.
Right, it's a good thing for right now. But like I said, then we switch off to wind tunnels, simulation programs, seven post rigs, that stuff to make up the difference. So, we never even turned a lap, and we wound up, we're holding our breath, you know, like, what's this thing going to do? We wound up, last year we qualified fifth, this year we qualified fourth. So,
that's amazing.
The longest 2 minutes in racing is when you unload the first, every week, you know, because a lot of times, I mean, people bring out new cars almost every week, and that's the longest 2 minutes in racing is that first two laps to see what you got.
Wow.
And especially at Daytona, if it doesn't run off the truck, it won't. You're gonna have to go home and cut it up and start over.
Wow.
You know, a lot of other racetracks you could work on them and get more out of them, but not Daytona and Talladega.
So what do you think about this weekend?
We're really optimistic about it.
You got the new motor.
Got the new motor. We race the new motor every week. And hopefully our simulation will be...
Jamie says the new motor has better cooling, allows you to tape the car up a little better.
For more downforce. Yeah, that's been good so far. Like I say, we've kind of been in on the development part of it. We raced it every week. So knock on wood, no issues. So.
Knock on wood, brothers. You know, getting to your point too, David, it's the sophistication of the software. It's not just that they banned testing. It's that the software has gotten so amazingly sophisticated.
Yeah, very sophisticated. And that was coming anyway. I mean, it was already started. It's just more, you talk about it more because that's the only thing you have to work with. Whereas before, you know, you go test every week somewhere, and now you just don't do that. But you still do testing in other forms. So, kind of all the same. I hadn't really thought about it until I got to talking about it, listening to myself talk. It's kind of the same.
Have you guys spent much time in the museum before? It's not your first time here.
This is our third trip this year.
Yeah.
No, we love this place. We're actually coming up early and going to do the village again. We were there a couple years ago.
It's pretty incredible. Yeah,
we didn't make it out early enough, so
we got season passes. So we kept coming in, and like we'd get a ticket, like we'd get the season pass. So we got season passes here.
That's excellent.
I was giving Lee Spencer a while ago, the lady that writes for Fox Sports. I gave her a tour through here. She'd never been
in
here.
No kidding. I know it that well.
I can be a curator in here.
Those big trains.
I love it. Yeah. Kennedy limo. I mean, we go race in Texas. We always go down to Dealey Plaza.
Yeah.
So we kind of connected to that.
Yeah.
I mean,
nice to live there. I've been down there too. It's
just change your life.
In fact, it's kind of morbid, but there's a simulation company here in Michigan, in Milford, that simulated the entire assassination.
Really?
And they even came in here and did all their measurements of the limousine to create the wireframe and then the full 3D version of the car.
Where did they drive it?
Pardon?
Where did they drive it?
They didn't. They just recreated the model of the car, created Dealey Plaza all digitally, and once you start lining things up, it's ABC did the whole thing. This goes back, I want to say, 5, 6 years ago, 7, 8 years ago, maybe. It's extraordinary.
You can't drive that route at Dealey Plaza anymore. They made, it was either Houston or Elm, I think Houston Street, one way.
Yeah, it is
so that
way.
You can't go, because people were just choking traffic up tourists driving the assassination. Yeah,
no, this is a digital model.
Yeah, I think I got a picture of the X in my pocket. Yeah, because we about got run over out there and getting our picture taken on the X.
Yeah. You can drive there, but you can't drive the whole motorcade route that they had. They switched the roads up.
Yeah, really what we always see is where they came across, then they took the
I mean, you can drive
took
the
left and went down there, then
it
right there.
Yeah.
It's so close.
Yeah.
It's like from where he...
Right. Less than 100 yards, I think.
Yeah,
right?
it's a lot smaller than you...
Right.
Than, you know.
Did you go to the Conspiracy Museum?
Oh, yeah. the guy that did the movie at Garrison...
Oliver Stone.
Yeah, he was there the day we were there.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we would walk up to him, like, get his autograph, and I said, you think you got this all figured out? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I said, how can you do that? He said, they don't bother me. And I said, okay. But it was it's pretty amazing that you go in and see all the facts that they know for sure, and then, you know, you can get a little tour from a guy hanging out there and where the hobos were and all that stuff and the grassy knoll.
The umbrella
and the
man.
Yeah. There's a guy there. So that's me in this picture, you know, when I was 8 years old. And
I remember one of the conspiracy, because the Conspiracy Museum has several theorists there. And you can walk through all of their
book
different...
Book depository right there.
Wow.
Just standing on the X.
Yeah, but there's that overpass right behind you.
Yeah, mine is.
Yeah. And the one guy had the theory that because it was a really sunny day, this guy's in a suit with an umbrella. And then he was the signal guy.
Right.
Telling the shooters when to go.
The Oliver Stone movie was the whole triangulation theory, right?
Yeah, it was...
Take a look at this... the simulation I'm talking about.
ABC used it.
ABC, they did a whole hour-long special on it, and it was I wish I could remember the name off the top of my head, but it was an engineering software firm in Milford, Michigan, that did the whole thing, and it's eye-opening.
It fascinates me, because I remember they let school out that afternoon.
Yeah.
And I was in third, fourth grade, and... Yeah. I remember getting off the school bus, and I was, because they said they hadn't got the guy yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was scared we live in Stuart, Virginia, and I was scared he was in Stuart. You know, I remember thinking, but then I was watching the TV when Ruby shot off.
I was watching that too live.
You know, sitting there.
Yeah, like, I was sitting there.
Yeah.
I was just like,
Yeah. Yeah, the same thing.
So, when did you guys first go to a racetrack? How old were you?
I can remember watching our dad race. Early as 8 years old, you know, at Bowman Gray Stadium, the madhouse, and we've seen it at stuff on TV.
Yeah.
Our dad raced there, and it was a madhouse then, just like it is now. And then he, shortly afterwards, he's 4 years younger than me.
1965, probably.
It's quite a trip.
Quite a legacy.
We went the first race I ever went to, like. Had me a shirt like that.
Yeah.
In fact, I had a shirt similar to that. And I might have had on short pants, which would have been stupid. I don't know why I did that. But they let me in the garage anyway, and the first person my dad carried me to meet was Richard Petty. Yeah. And Dale Inman and Maurice Petty and Lee, the whole family. And I'll never forget that. Uh-huh. You know, that was a big deal to me.
Still is a big deal.
It still is a big deal. Richard Petty's a big deal.
Yes, he is. That's why they call him the king.
That's right. He deserves it.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, we wish you guys the best this weekend.
Yeah, we really do.
Thank you. Like to see Ford, it. You know, get back in it.
Thank you. They're working really hard. Everybody is.
I know you are. It's great to meet you.
Yeah.
It's an honor to meet you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thanks for having us on. Now I can tell I talk to you.
And the last interview for this podcast is
Patricia Meradian, the president of the Henry Ford Museum itself.
All right. So you run this whole place. You're the president of the Henry Ford.
How did you come upon that job? How did you get there?
You know, I've been working for a lot of years. I've been here for 10 years, and I started as a vice president. Mm-hmm. Then I became a chief operating officer, and then 5 years ago, I became president. But before that, I worked for 13 years with Taubman in corporate business. Okay. And
so is this strategy the most fun job you've ever had?
This is the best job in the world. I guarantee it. It is the best job. It's hard. It's a hard job. There's a lot of work and a lot of complexity to it.
Well, it's rewarding, I take it.
It's very rewarding.
And the whole concept of a museum has been evolving. I mean, not just this one.
You know, our mission has always been the same. For the 81 years since our founding with Henry Ford, our mission has been to bring the American traditions of innovation, ingenuity, and resourcefulness to life in ways that immerse people in the stories and engage them in the stories. And our whole goal is to inspire people to learn in order to make a difference in the world. So we always say, when is the next Thomas Edison going to walk through the doors, or when is the next Henry Ford, or the next Rosa Parks? And these are all people who had very ordinary beginnings, like most of us, who just happened to have some of those characteristics that really propelled them to do something great. And that's what really gets me going here.
So how many kids come through here a year?
Well, we have about 250,000 school children on field trips.
Wow.
But we get many children that come with their families as regular visitors. And in total, we have 1.6 million people that walk through our doors on an annual basis.
That's amazing. So
it's a lot of people.
What is the museum? Is it the family or is it the company?
Neither.
Foundation?
Neither. It is it's held in the public trust. It's a 501c3. So it's a private nonprofit. And we work for the good of the public. We serve.
Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I got to ask you, what's your favorite part of the museum, and what is your favorite artifact? Is that the right
artifact,
word to use?
Artifact. Okay. I don't know if I have a favorite part. My favorite thing that happens is more of an experience, and it's watching people experience this place and seeing something that just is like a light bulb that goes off for them, it lights them up, whether it's a child or an adult. That's what, and a lot of times it's also from our staff, because they tell us the stories of all of the different people who come through and what happens to them and some of the experiences they have. I'll give you an example. The other day I was walking through the promenade to a meeting. It was just a regular day. You never know what's going to happen. And as I'm coming down the staircase right out front under the chandelier, one of our presenters came up and she said, hurry, hurry, you're going to miss it. And I said, what? And she said, you'll see. There was a touring group of about 50 6th, 7th, 8th grade boys who were part of a boys choir from Texas. And they were so inspired by the physical space that the choir director lined them up, and right on the spot, they sang God Bless America. And I caught the whole thing, and it was, I mean, you get tears in your eyes. It was just an inspiring moment. And that's the kind of thing that this place evokes. So that's why, I mean, I love it. Now, my favorite artifact, there are many, but I do love the Rosa Parks bus. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I get on that Rosa Parks bus, there's something that happens, and it transforms you, and it transforms people. And that's one of the other things I love about the work we do here, because we don't just put things behind glass cases or with ropes around them. Some things, yes, you have to.
Yeah.
But when you can, we let people get in them. And the bus is a prime example of that. All the buildings in Greenfield Village are open and accessible for people to learn from and really experience, and many of the other artifacts. We've worked actually hard in the last couple of years to open up the Allegheny train. Mm-hmm. And now kids and people, there's a little platform and some steps, and you can go in and you can see what it must have been like to drive that. And I went up there for the first time and I thought, how did they see where they were going? There's no way to stick their head out. You know, all those conductors, when you see they're sticking their head out, that's what they're doing.
That's right. At least the tracks are pretty straight.
We opened up the combine. That's this huge combine over there in the agriculture area. And it's one of the most visited spots now. And before, you know, people would just walk by and look at it. And now you can get in it. It makes a world of difference. It's fun.
So is that McDonald's sign? Is that one of the originals, or is that just the McDonald's?
No, it's one of the originals. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Isn't it cool? Yeah.
So what inspired you to go for this kind of job? Are you a history buff, a car buff? What?
Actually, no. I'm not. I mean, I love history, but I wasn't a history buff. I love the idea of serving the public and preserving these stories to inspire other people to do things. I mean, for myself, I always say, you know, I want to be my best self, the best person I can be. And the stories that these artifacts inspire are some of the best stories ever in our history. And so serving the public and educating people, and we say we're all educators, and we are, because the work that we do and the way we put it forth is educational. But it's fun, and it's history with a twist. And we say we're American history, but we're about the future. We're not a stuffy institution about just the stories of the past. We make all those connections to the future, and we try and inspire people to make a better world. And that's what we all need.
Does.
And we have the best historians on our staff. So,
they do. I can vouch for that. The docents here are
best
spectacular.
The curators are
amazing.
And it isn't just the curators. A lot our program staff. I mean, the history degrees, masters, PhDs. They're the best, and they know their stuff, and they know how to present it in a way that really appeals to the visitors that are walking through the door, no matter what the age. And that's what, it's just so fun to watch.
One of my favorite icons or artifacts or things that you have here is, I think it's like a 1790 or 1780 Watt steam engine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That Henry Ford sent people over to just scour the English countryside, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Trying to find real old stuff that was just falling apart.
And have you ever walked through those with Mark Gruther?
Yes. Yes.
They come to
your
life.
Your people really know their stuff.
Yeah, they come to life in ways that, you know, it's hard to even express. You have to just experience it. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of fun.
So one last quick question then. Why racing? You've talked all about you want to help the human race and all that. Why racing?
Well, it makes a lot of sense for us with racing. I mean, we have the greatest transportation exhibition area with flight, and we have it with the automobiles. We've been collecting race cars for a very long time, and the array that we've collected really makes sense. They're paradigm-changing cars. They tell the story of all forms of American racing. It hasn't been done before. So we look for ways to differentiate ourselves and ways that we can give back, and this is a big way that we can do it. So it makes a lot of sense for us.
Great.
We're thrilled.
Well, thanks so much for coming by and telling us all about your museum.
Thanks, and thanks for coming. And this isn't my museum, it's the People's Museum.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Anytime.
Take care.
Thank you.
Good. That wraps up this discussion that we've had with all the different racing people at the Henry Ford Museum. But don't forget, we still talked all about the latest news this week in the second part of the podcast. Check that out. Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outofline.detroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.